deals made to cope. Ideas in decline. Rise of the lost. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Hey, here we stand. Slave to networks, master plans. Swags the brand, open a can. Chains off still, y'all never ran. But who do you think you are?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Caitlin Klein, a former credit derivatives trader and a founding member of Occupy SEC, which is a working group within Occupy Wall Street composed of former finance professionals, lawyers, and concerned citizens working to counter corporate influence in the regulatory rulemaking process as a sort of anti-lobby. OSEC recently submitted a 325-page comment letter to the SEC and other regulators on the so-called Volcker Rule, arguing for strong regulation and oversight of federally backstopped banks and the prohibition of risky activity within them. Welcome to Background Briefing, Caitlin Klein.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And just a couple of days ago in the New York Times, there was an op-ed by Phil Angelides, the former head of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which Congress created to examine the full scope of the 2008 Wall Street financial meltdown. And he said, 4 years after the financial crisis, that nothing's happened, and all of the stuff that he looked into, even though they gave him no money to work with, and little subpoena power, he's the Justice Department haven't done anything with the information that he's provided them with. What's going on here? It seems like the guy that won the Academy Award for that wonderful documentary, Inside Job, at the Academy Awards last year, said nobody's gone to jail. So it's not like the public and the people out in America aren't saying what happened here and why no justice. So what's your answer to that question? Why no justice?
It's one of these things that it obviously takes a very, very long time to get anything substantial done in Washington. And, it's a problem certainly that we've seen for the past decade and coming through the financial crisis. And it feels right now as if they're at least starting to make use of some of the tools that they were given through the Dodd-Frank Act to sort of figure out what went wrong and try and make it right, which is, a few steps before going through and actually assigning blame. I would think that they would like to try and at least prohibit it from happening again right now. And, hopefully later on there's something that they can do to go and hold individuals accountable. But this is one thing that something we focused on that the Volcker Rule is really aiming to do. And it's trying to go in and say, what exactly were people doing at the time that really led to such a crisis? And what can we do to try and make sure that that doesn't happen again? And it really stems from the separation of commercial banks and investment banks that happened back with the Glass-Steagall Act. And, really for most of the century in the 1900s, it really made some very, responsible changes in the banking industry, not allowing investment banks and commercial banks to, merge and use your deposits to be able to go and basically gamble individuals' money. And that worked reasonably well for a long time. And as deregulation started to happen later on in the century, those two very separate functions really got pretty clouded and they merged together in a lot of ways. And what happened is people could start to use this government federally backstopped money to go and make very, very risky bets. And you'll see this in, all of the inflation in any financial product that we have these days, from, risky derivatives like credit default swaps all the way to, speculation in oil prices, which is one of the reasons we're seeing these prices at the pump these days. And if you're going to try and counter that particular problem, this idea of, too much really cheap money and too much moral hazard that these banks have, you have to go back and say, what did we do to make these things happen in the first place and how can we get them? And if we can finally fix that problem and kind of get back on track to a system where, things are reasonably regulated and these markets are functioning in a way that makes a little bit more sense, maybe at that point they can finally go and say, who were the actual criminals here? But, I feel like they want to kind of try and stop the flood before they start going through and really trying to place blame at this point.
Well, in a way, though, Caitlin, if you had a perp walk with some of these big bankers, as happened back in the SNL crisis, I've talked to Bill Black, the chief prosecutor, a number of times back then. He put about 1,000 people behind bars, and a perp walk would be a kind of teachable moment, because and the trials that follow, at least the public would find out what these people were up to. One of the problems that I understand is, particularly with getting rid of Glass-Steagall, et cetera, is a lot of the extraordinary criminality and fraud was actually legal.
Sure. And this is something that we've really focused on in you know, looking at the specifics of the Volcker Rule. What was really remarkable about it was that, you know, they tended to use about 300 pages describing what you can and can't do and, you know, what the specifics should look like, but nowhere in the whole rule did they impose any real penalties. They said you can't do speculation, you can't do any risky activities, but nowhere did they say what would happen to you if you did. It seems like the kind of the strongest penalty that they had was saying, if we find you're doing what would be an illegal activity, you have to take that trade off. And that was basically it. And that is not the kind of, you know, strict penalty that's really going to encourage these people to not do these things. So, you know, one thing is making them illegal. I mean, I think one thing you would have to look back over time and say, realistically, based on what the regulatory environment was for the past decade, most of what we now see as very clearly fraudulent or criminal behavior, it wasn't necessarily explicitly illegal at the time. So it's really hard to go back and say, you know, these people were, you know, what was obviously probably not tremendously moral activity might not have been explicit violations of the law. And it's really important that they get this part right when they're trying to figure out how to fix this mess, is to figure out exactly what is wrong and exactly what people should be afraid of if they're going to try and avert this law in some way.
Well, what about the role of the press, though, in the Fourth Estate, Caitlin Klein, in informing the public? I mean, the public have a lot of anger about what happened. And after all, it was the anger about what happened on Wall Street that propelled the Tea Party into existence. And curiously enough, you know, the political left in this country, the Democrats, should have owned that issue, and they let it slip through their fingers, which I find quite mystifying. But look what's happening now with the price of gasoline. Almost every day you have stories on local TV news and in newspapers about the high price of gas. None of it is really looking into what's really behind it. And it's not as if we haven't seen this movie before. Back in the summer of 2008, gasoline oil went up to $147 a barrel. And then 60 Minutes exposed the fact that it was all to do with speculation through the Goldman Sachs index. And 80% of the, or to 90% of the contracts apparently now, future contracts for oil aren't being bought up by the end users like oil refineries and airlines, but by speculators. And there is a global glut of oil. There's much less global demand, more supply. The same applies here in the United States. So the external, anybody could find this out in 1 second. I don't get it.
No, and it's something that is a little bit kind of unique in some ways to the financial industry, is the idea that a lot of times the public feel as if they're not, you know, they're not informed enough to be making decisions on this or to be kind of accurately judging things. And you can easily get, you know, this very powerful and vocal lobby from the financial industry saying, no, we're doing everything right. You just don't understand. It's a supply and demand problem. You guys don't get it. You know, we're doing the best that we can, and this is just what happens in the market. And this is very clearly not true. But I think that a lot of times the public isn't so confident in stepping in and saying, wait a second, you know, this doesn't make a lot of sense. These things don't, you know, everybody's kind of basic understanding of economics is really violated by what you're saying. But, you know, they're men in suits, and they sound pretty convincing, and this is something that people kind of take for granted. And, you know, one of the most remarkable things that we've noticed, and now it's been 2 years or more since they've been trying to get this Dodd-Frank Act passed, and kind of at the beginning of it, there was so much public outcry of against bankers and what they were doing. And somehow in this past 2 years, that really vocal, you know, animosity from the public has really subdued a lot. And you can see that by the way in which the lobbyists are coming through and making these sweeping judgments and really putting influence on the rulemaking process because people aren't complaining anymore. And they have, you know, happily stepped back into this position of saying, no, what we do is very important to the public and to the economy, and everybody is really reliant on us doing this great job. And that, you know, yelling and screaming from the public isn't there anymore. And, you know, it's pretty frustrating because that's an incredibly important part of this fight, is not only the banks, but also, you know, the regulators knowing that they have the public on their side if they're trying to come up with really strong, useful enforcement.
So, Caitlin Klein, again, a former credit derivatives trader and a founding member of Occupy SEC, which is a working group within Occupy Wall Street composed of former financial professionals, lawyers, and concerned citizens working to counter corporate influence in the regulatory rulemaking process as a sort of counter lobby. Are you suggesting then, Caitlin, that what the Wall Street culture has done is create a kind of a priesthood with with all of this sort of Byzantine theology that's really ultimately just smoke and mirrors? And is that what's going on?
I think very much. I mean, I think that, you know, you have people like Ben Bernanke sitting in these very smart, very accomplished people who can basically say whatever they want, right? And they can get these ideas across because nobody really wants to stand up and say, I know better than this man. And unfortunately, most of the elite in, you know, certainly the economics and financial economics professions, they're all kind of on the same team in that capacity. And outside voices and critical voices aren't usually heard, certainly aren't heard loudly enough. And, you know, it's a pretty unfortunate part. You know, it would be the same thing as if, you know, physicists had a seat at the policy table. It would be difficult for, you know, regular mom-and-pop kind of people to come in and say, you know, I don't think what you're saying is true. Right. And so they kind of get this free pass without oversight that makes it very, very difficult for people to, you know, kind of call them on things that don't necessarily make sense. You know, when they say, but why is my gas prices so high? This affects me on a day-to-day basis. You know, this man seems to think that it all makes sense, and I kind of just have to take that. And it's pretty unfortunate.
Well, I guess in a way, Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Fed, was the greatest practitioner of mumbo-jumbo and smoke and mirrors.
Absolutely. And you know, this has been something, I don't think it's an accident that this is the way it is, right? Mm. You know, they, very much the, even academically, the economics profession is, you know, there is a very clear agenda, and this is taught from day one, and there, it's kind of a machine that gets these people, you know, even, you know, the very basic kind of free market economics that's taken as gospel. You know, there's a lot of contrary voices out there that say, you know, maybe a lot of this doesn't make sense, but you just don't hear about that. It's just not institutionalized in that mm-hmm. way.
So, Caitlin Klein, you're a former credit derivatives trader. I recall Warren Buffett referred to derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. And I talked to an entrepreneur the other day who had a lot of experience in the finance world and has done very well for himself. He was saying that that's the big ticking bomb out there, what, 700 trillion or something, unbelievable number. Tell us about what's out there as this kind of financial iceberg looming while we rearrange deck chairs on the Titanic.
So there's just this whole industry that is based around creating products that can, you know, potentially provide value at some point to some person. And that some person isn't always the economy at whole. In fact, you know, in recent years, it's often not. It's often a few people who kind of have a stake in creating, you know, extremely complex, you know, things that have price exposures all over the place. And, you know, if you were to ask a credit derivatives trader on the street what they do, they would say, oh, we dissipate risk. You know, this is a thing that we trade that helps people offset their risk and take the specific pieces that they want and spread the rest out, and it helps the economy and it keeps things, you know, working smoothly. And you kind of can look right now, particularly as Greece is approaching default, and this whole market that has shown up around credit derivatives was supposed to dissipate the risk that would happen in a default is a complete mess, and people are on the line for a lot of money because these products don't have any inherent social value. And it's very difficult to look in the times of trouble and say, you know, people are going to lose a lot of money because they created this sort of pseudo-market. And this happens in all products. There's derivatives on basically anything. You can get a weather derivative, you know, and they basically cover almost any aspect of human life, and people have money waged on these things. And it's a kind of a very scary time, because it used to be something that you could look at financial markets and say, okay, I kind of get a stock and I get a bond. These are things that I understand, and I can monitor them on a day-to-day basis, and it can kind of all these pieces of this puzzle can come together. It's much harder to do that now as you get more and more risky securities, and the world of finance is so unbelievably intertwined, and there's so much risk from so many different places all interconnecting itself. This is one of the biggest challenges that they have for too big to fail, because you have these massively huge organizations that are all very, very much in bed with each other, and the decline of one could mean the decline of all of them, and that's a very, very scary thing for, you know, the future of regular people.
Well, we've recently had the scandal involving Corzine, a former head of Goldman Sachs, and then went on to become a U.S. senator, and then went back to Wall Street and managed to tank this organization, and a whole bunch of money, I think $1.6 billion or so, disappeared. And apparently the money can't be found. I mean, talk about financial alchemy. They just make stuff disappear, and nobody can pin it on anybody.
And this is a pretty funny one, because you kind of have to sit back and say somebody somewhere knows where this money is. But there is no real attempt, you know, there's no real global outrage for people to say, no, just find it. Money doesn't disappear these days. It should be quite possible to go and track a series of money transfers and figure out where this is all sitting. And it's that kind of remarkable ability to sort of put a sheet over it and say, oh, no, this is just a thing that we can't quite figure out right now. Oh, well, avert your eyes. There's other news going on. And these kinds of, you know, $1.6 billion is more than a slight blip. Something very serious happened organizationally in this process, and there was a huge failure on a lot of ends, and it's important for us to know what that was. I mean, you have to keep in mind that MF Global was a primary dealer, and they were able to borrow from the Fed, and this is, you know, this is something that affects everybody, because taxpayer dollars are actually at stake here. But, you know, this idea that it was kind of this isolated incident, it wasn't a big bank, it didn't require a bailout per se, so we don't really care, is pretty troubling.
Now, in terms of the cop on the beat, Mary Shapiro, her predecessor, Donaldson, apparently was a fairly decent guy under Bush, trying to do the right thing. Bush fired him, I assume, with pressure from Wall Street, because the guy was actually trying to do his job. Then they put in this disgraceful guy called Christopher Cox, who was just not only an ideologue, but was stupid. That's when the whole crash happened. Obama had a chance to put a good cop on the beat, and my understanding is that Mary Shapiro is not that person.
Yeah, I think in kind of the greater sense of who could have ended up in that position, particularly coming off people like Christopher Cox, you know, I think we could have done a lot worse. I think we've been really discouraged for, you know, certainly some remarks she's made lately, you know, particularly with respect to the Volcker Rule, saying things along the lines of, no, we're not going to go and persecute anyone for any little trade that doesn't follow it. You know, we're just going to kind of try and wait for big violations and that stuff. Don't worry, we're not looking too closely. Business as usual. I mean, this is really, you know, the opposite of what, like you said, the cop on the beat should be saying. You know, they should be saying, we're going to be after you for everything that you do, and we're going to be watching, and it's important that all banks and everyone that we regulate follows the rules. And that's the opposite of the rhetoric she's given, and it's really frustrating, particularly as a member of the public, believing that there needs to be someone on your side here. And it would be really nice to know that you had somebody there who really had the right priorities in mind, you know, someone like, you know, Brooksley Bourne, for instance, at the CFTC, like these are things that would have been really nice for us to have someone on our side. And it really doesn't feel that way. Not really in many of the agencies do we feel like, you know, the priorities are in order.
Well, just in closing, Caitlin Klein, tell us about how your group, Occupy SEC, has been working within the Occupy Wall Street movement, because we've spoken a lot with Occupy Wall Street. Not that there's anybody you know, in charge of it, but I'd like to get an understanding of how you're working together.
So Occupy the SEC is a working group within the Occupy Wall Street movement. We are an autonomous group. We don't speak for Occupy, obviously. But we are all individuals who kind of came together in the New York City General Assembly area because we were all people who used to work in finance or were somehow related to it or had a, you know, a keen interest in it and saw that, you know, right now there's this big opportunity for us to really use what we know and try and have a voice about these rules that are being put in place to potentially stop future financial crisis from happening. So we kind of got together and started to have effectively a book club where our book was this proposed Volcker rule. And the idea was to kind of go through it and read it line by line and figure out what needs to be said to counter what the lobbyists will be trying to say when they go through and submit their letters. Because typically in this process, the only people who ever really comment are the banks and their lobbyists. The public really turns away after the rule itself has been written. So we wanted to shine a light on this part of the process. It's incredibly important. And, you know, together through our expertise and other contacts that we made within the Occupy Wall Street movement, there's a lot of really brilliant minds out there who want to make a change. And we're hoping to use it as a venue to really promote, you know, this idea that there are other people out there who care and know enough about this to really try and make sure that the rulemaking process works for people and not just for banks.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Caitlin Klein.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Caitlin Klein, a former credit derivatives trader and a founding member of Occupy SEC, which is a working group within Occupy Wall Street, composed of former finance professionals, lawyers, and concerned citizens working to counter corporate influence in the regulatory rulemaking process as a sort of anti-lobby. Occupy SEC recently submitted a 325-page comment letter to the SEC and other regulators on the so-called Volcker Rule, arguing for strong regulations and oversight of federally backstopped banks and the prohibition of risky activities within them. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nicholas Walrath. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.